when this is all over, that you, there'll be a place for you at the table. There'll be a spot for you at the Supreme Court like there was for Judge Ginsburg. And to President Trump, I don't know if you're listening or not, by picking Judge Barrett, you have publicly said you find value in all of these characteristics. But beyond anything else, you find Judge Barrett to be highly qualified. I would say you're one of the greatest picks President Trump could have made. And from the conservative side of the aisle, you're one of the most qualified people of your generation. Let's talk about Brown versus Board of Education, because I know Senator Blumenthal will. I'm going to talk about that. You said in writings it was a super precedent. What did you mean?
Well, in my writings, so as a professor, I talked about the doctrine of stare decisis. And super precedent is not a doctrinal term that comes from the Supreme Court. And I think maybe in political conversation or in newspapers, people use it different ways. But in my writing, I was using a framework that's been articulated by other scholars. And in that context, super precedent means precedent that is so well established that it would be unthinkable that it would ever be overruled. And there are about six cases on this list that other scholars have identified.
Let's talk about Brown and talk about why it would be unthinkable. First, let's talk about what's the process that would lead to it being overruled. What would have to happen?
For Brown to be overruled, you would have to have Congress or some state or local government impose segregation again, open segregation.
Okay, let's stop right there. If you want to make yourself famous, by the end of the day, you can say we want to go back to segregation. I promise you, you'll be on every cable TV channel in America. I doubt if you'll go very far, but the point we're trying to make here is the court just can't wake up and say, let's revisit Brown. It has to be a case in controversy. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
So before a Brown decision, you could review Brown, somebody out there would have to be dumb enough to pass a law saying, let's go back to segregated schools. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say.
Do you see that happening anytime soon?
I do not see that happening anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't either. So let's talk about the process in general. There's the Heller case. What's that about?
The Heller case is a case decided by the Supreme Court, which held that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms.
Okay. Now, my friends on the left, some of them have a problem with Heller. They may try to challenge the construct of Heller. If a state or local government passed a law in defiance of Heller, what would happen?
In defiance of Heller? Or
that was challenging the construct of Heller.
That challenged the construct of Heller. If it was brought in a lower court, Heller binds. I mean, lower courts always have to follow Supreme Court precedent, and so that.
And if the Supreme Court wanted to revisit Heller, what would they do?
If someone challenged Heller below because a state or local government passed a law contradicting Heller, the Supreme Court would have to take that case once it was appealed all the way up. So the court would have to decide, yes, we want to overrule Heller, and we have enough votes to grant cert, and then do so.
So that's the way the process works.
Yes, it would start because there was a law, then there was a lawsuit, then there was an appeal, then the court granted cert, and then the court decided the case.
Is that true no matter what the issue is, whether it's gun, abortion, health care, campaign finance? Does that process hold true for everything?
Yes, judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda, I like guns, I hate guns, I like abortion, I hate abortion, and walk in like a royal queen and impose, you know, their will on the world. You have to wait for cases and controversies, which is the language of the Constitution, to wind their way through the process.
All right. Well, Senator Sass gave us a good civics lesson. I hope that's the basic lesson in law here. So if a state said, you know, I don't think you should have over six bullets, and somebody believed that violated the Second Amendment, there would be a lawsuit and the same process would work, right?
The same process would work. In that case, there would be parties would have to sue the state who, arguing that that law was unconstitutional. It would wind its way up. And if it got to the Supreme Court, and if the Supreme Court decided to take it, a whole decision-making process begins. You hear arguments from litigants on both sides. They write briefs. You talk to clerks as a judge. You talk to your colleagues. Then you write an opinion. Opinions circulate, and you get feedback from your colleagues. So it's an entire process. It's not something that a judge or justice would wake up and say, oh, we're hearing this case. I know what my vote's going to be.
Let's talk about the two Supreme Court cases regarding abortion. What are the two leading cases in America regarding abortion?
Well, I think most people think of Roe versus Wade, and Casey is the case after Roe that preserved Roe's central holding, but grounded it in a slightly different rationale.
So what is that rationale?
Rationale is that the state cannot impose an undue burden on a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy.
Okay, unlike Brown, there are states challenging on the abortion front. There are states that are going to a fetal heartbeat bill. I have a bill, Judge, that would disallow abortion on demand at the 20 weeks, the fifth month of the pregnancy. We're one of seven nations in the entire world that allow abortion on demand at the fifth month. The construct of my bill is because a child is capable of feeling pain in the fifth month, doctors tell us to save the child's life, you have to provide anesthesia if you operate because they can feel pain. The argument I'm making is if you have to provide anesthesia to save the child's life because they can feel pain, it must be a terrible death to be dismembered by an abortion. That's a theory to protect the unborn at the fifth month. If that litigation comes before you, will you listen to both sides?
Of course. I'll do that in every case.
So I think 14 states have already passed a version of what I've just described. So there really is a debate in America still, unlike Brown versus Board of Education, about the rights of the unborn. That's just one example. So if there's a challenge coming from a state, if a state passes a law and it goes into court where people say this violates Casey, how do you decide that?
Well, it would begin in a district court, in a trial court. You know, the trial court would make a record. You know, the parties would litigate and fully develop that record in the trial court. Then it would go up to a court of appeals that would review that record looking for error. And then, again, it would be the same process. Someone would have to seek certiorari at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would have to grant it. And then at that point, it would be the full judicial process. It would be briefs, oral argument, conversations with law clerks in chambers, consultation with colleagues, writing an opinion, really digging down into it. It's not just a vote. You all do that. You all have a policy and you cast a vote. The judicial process is different.
Okay. So when it comes to your personal views about this topic, do you own a gun?
We do own a gun.
Okay. All right. Do you think you could fairly decide a case even though you own a gun?
Yes.
All right. You're Catholic.
I am.
I think we've established that. The tenets of your faith mean a lot to you personally. Is that correct?
That is true.
You've chosen to raise your family in the Catholic faith. Is that correct?
That's true.
Can you set aside whatever Catholic beliefs you have regarding any issue before you?
I can. I have done that in my time on the Seventh Circuit. If I stay on the Seventh Circuit, I'll continue to do that. If I'm confirmed to the Supreme Court, I will do that still.
And I would dare say that there are personal views on the Supreme Court, and nobody questions whether our liberal friends can set aside their beliefs. There's no reason to question yours, in my view. So the bottom line here is that there's a process. You fill in the blanks, whether it's about guns in Heller, abortion rights. Let's go to Citizens United. To my good friend, Senator Whitehouse, me and you are going to come closer and closer about regulating money, because I don't know what's going on out there, but I can tell you there's a lot of money being raised in this campaign. I'd like to know where the hell some of it's coming from. But that's not your problem. Citizens United says what?
Citizens United extends the protection of the First Amendment to corporations who are engaged in political speech.
So if Congress wanted to revisit that and somebody challenged it under Citizens United that Congress went too far, what would you do? How would the process work?
Well, it would be the same process I've been describing. First, somebody would have to challenge that law in a case, somebody presumably who wanted to spend the money in a political campaign. It would wind its way up and, you know, judges would decide it after briefs and oral argument and consultation with colleagues and the process of opinion writing.
Okay. Same-sex marriage. What's the case that established same-sex marriage as the law of the land?
Obergefell.
Okay. If there was a state who tried to outlaw same-sex marriage and there's litigation, would it follow the same process?
Well, it would, and one thing I've neglected to say before that's occurring to me now is that not only would someone have to challenge that statute, and, you know, somebody, so if they outlawed same-sex marriage, there'd have to be a case challenging it, and for the Supreme Court to take it up, you'd have to have lower courts going along and saying, we're going to flout Obergefell. And the most likely result would be that lower courts, who are bound by Obergefell, would shut such a lawsuit down and it wouldn't make its way up to the Supreme Court. But if it did, it would be the same process I've described.
Well, let's turn now to Senator Hawley's favorite topic, substantive due process. As a legal theory, what am I talking about? Can you explain it for the country? Because if you can't, we're in trouble. I think I'll have a hard time doing it.
So both the 14th and 5th Amendments protect life or provide that the state cannot take life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And that sounds like a procedural guarantee, but in Supreme Court precedent, it has a substantive component. And so the substantive due process clause says that there are some liberties, some rights that people possess that the state can't take away or can't take away without a really good reason. So the right to use birth control, the right to no abortion are examples of rights protected by substantive due process.
These are judicially created rights not found in the document called the Constitution. Is that correct?
Well, the Supreme Court has grounded them in the Constitution.
But they're not written.
They're not expressed.
Okay. So is it fair to say there's a great debate in the law about how far this should go and what limits should apply, if any?
That's fair to say. There's also a lot of debate in Supreme Court opinions. I'm not aware of anybody proposing to throw it over entirely, but there's certainly a debate about how to define these rights and how far it should go.
Well, let's just say that you're in the camp, or anybody's in the camp, that substantive due process as a legal concept is unbounded. It basically makes the Constitution no more certain than the five people interpreting it at any given time in the country. Whatever rights they think you have, you get. Whatever rights they want to take away from you, they can. It's a pretty nebulous legal concept. That's sort of my view of it. I'm not imposing my views on yours. But then there's a thing called precedent. Let's say you didn't like a case decided under substantive due process. You thought the whole concept was constitutionally an error. How does precedent play?
So precedent is the principle that cases that have been decided by the court before this one lands on the docket are presumptively controlling. And so, you know, precedent comes from a concept called stare decisis, which is a shorthand for a longer Latin phrase that means stand by the thing decided and do not disturb the calm. So precedent is a principle that you're not going to overrule something without good reason or roil up the law without justification for doing so.
So you could say the underlying analysis that led to any case, just case X, I reject that analysis, but I will now apply precedent to whether or not it should be reversed. Is that what you're telling us?
That is, because okay. Precedent is...
What are the factors would a judge look at in terms of overruling a precedent?
Well, of course, the inquiry begins because there's been some argument that the precedent was wrong. But that's not enough to justify an overruling. You also consider...
You could say structurally this case should... constitutionally it was wrongly decided, but that doesn't end the debate. Is that correct?
No, that's right. You have to look at reliance interests. You have to look whether the law or the facts...
Let's stop right quick. Reliance interest by who?
Reliance interest by those who have relied on the precedent. So
the people of the United States.
People of the United States who've ordered their affairs around it.
So the Heller case, people have relied upon the Second Amendment being an individual right. Is that correct?
Precedent, yeah, presumably so. People
yeah.
have.
Well, abortion would be the right to have abortion. That'd be a reliance factor, right?
The court in Casey spent a lot of time describing the reliance of people okay. on the right to an abortion.
So what I want the public to know is that if you overrule a precedent of the court, even if you think it was wrongly decided, there's a list of things you have to look at before you actually overrule the case. Is that a fair way of saying it?
It's a fair way of saying it.
Would you apply those factors if you ever found yourself in a position where you wanted to consider overruling a precedent?
Absolutely.
Okay. Have precedents of the court been overruled before?
Yes.
Can you give me an example?
Brown versus the Board of Education overruled Plessy versus Ferguson to get rid of the separate but equal doctrine.
So, recusal. My colleagues are asking you to recuse yourself from litigation around the Affordable Care Act. What's the precedent regarding the Affordable Care Act, if any?
The precedent that might, well...
Is there precedent on this issue?
There's not precedent on the issue that's coming up before the court. It turns on a doctrine called severability, which was not an issue in either the two big Affordable Care Act cases.
Okay, so the issue that was before the court was NFIB versus Sebelius, is that correct?
That was the first about the constitutionality of the mandate.
Okay, and I think Congress has zeroed out what the court called a tax, and the real issue now is, does it stand and can it be severable?
Right, so the issue now that Congress has zeroed it out, can it be called a tax or is it now a penalty? And then the second issue is, if it is a penalty, can it be just cut out from the statute so that the rest of the statute, including protection for pre-existing conditions, stands?
Well, a lot smarter people than me suggest that severability would be a hard challenge for those who are opposing the law, but time will tell. Do you feel like you should recuse yourself from that case because you're being nominated by President Trump?
Well, Senator, recusal itself is a legal issue. You know, there's a statute, 28 U.S.C. 455, that governs when judges and justices have to recuse. There's precedent under that rule. Justice Ginsburg, in explaining the way recusal works, said that it's always up to the individual justice, but it always involves consultation with the colleagues, with the other eight justices. So that's not a question that I could answer in the abstract.
So if you're appointed by Obama, that's no reason to recuse yourself in a case involving Obama policy. Is that correct?
Well, that would be a decision for each justice to make.
But if a justice had a conflict with a particular policy issue, they helped draft it, that would be a consideration. Is that correct?
That would be a consideration.
Okay. So when it comes to recusing yourself, you'll do what the Supreme Court requires of every justice?
I will.
Okay. Thank you very much. How does it feel to be nominated for the Supreme Court of the United States?
Well, Senator, I've tried to be on a media blackout for the sake of my mental health, but, you know, you can't keep yourself walled off from everything, and I'm aware of a lot of the caricatures that are floating around. So I think what I would like to say in response to that question is that, look, I've made distinct choices. I've decided to pursue a career and have a large family. I have a multiracial family. Our faith is important to us. All of those things are true, but they are my choices. And in my personal interactions with people, I mean, I have a life brimming with people who've made different choices, and I've never tried in my personal life to impose my choices on them. And the same is true professionally. I mean, I apply the law, and Senator, I think I should say why I'm sitting in this seat in response to that question, too. Why I've agreed to be here, because I don't think it's any secret to any of you or to the American people that this is a really difficult, some might say excruciating, process. And Jesse and I had a very brief amount of time to make a decision with momentous consequences for our family. We knew that our lives would be combed over for any negative detail. We knew that our faith would be caricatured. We knew our family would be attacked. And so we had to decide whether those difficulties would be worth it, because what sane person would go through that if there wasn't a benefit on the other side? And the benefit, I think, is that I'm committed to the rule of law and the role of the Supreme Court in dispensing equal justice for all. And I'm not the only person who could do this job, but I was asked, and it would be difficult for anyone. So why should I say someone else should do the difficulty if the difficulty is the only reason to say no, I should serve my country? And my family's all in on that because they share my belief in the rule of law.
Well, thank you. I think a lot of people would say you got to be sort of insane to run for the Senate in this world. But the good news for you, we've all chosen kind of crazy stuff to do. I just end with this. I'm glad you said yes. I'm glad President Trump chose you. And really, before the people of the United States, is a very basic question. Is it okay to be religiously conservative? Is it okay to be pro-life in your personal life? It clearly is okay to be progressive and be pro-choice and seek the a seat on the Supreme Court. I think resoundingly yes. And here's why your nomination is so important to me. In my world, to be a young conservative woman is not an easy path to take. We have two women on this committee. They can talk about it better than I. So I want to thank President Trump for choosing you, and I will do everything I can to make sure that you have a seat at the table. And that table is the Supreme Court. And if anybody in the country, in my view, deserves to have a seat at the table based on the way they've lived their life and their capabilities in the law, it is you, Judge. God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Graham.
Senator Feinstein.
Mr. Chairman, Judge, it's wonderful to see you here, also with the family that I have been observing.
This is Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. She is the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I was wondering if you might introduce us to them.
Sure. So I have my husband, Jesse, my son, JP, my daughter, Emma, my daughter, Juliet, my daughter, Tess, my daughter, Vivian, and my son, Liam. And then behind them are my six siblings who are with me today. I'll start at the side right behind Vivian. It's my sister, Vivian, my sister, Eileen, my brother, Michael, my sister, Megan, and my sister, Amanda. And is Carrie in the room? And my sister, Carrie, is sitting right over there.
You don't have a magic formula for how you do it and handle all the children and your job and your work and your thought process, which is obviously excellent, do you?
It's improv.
Yes, yes. Well, let me begin with a question that the chairman touched on. And it's of great importance, I think, because it goes to a woman's fundamental right to make the most personal decisions about their own body. And as a college student in the 1950s, I saw what happened to young women who became pregnant at a time when abortion was not legal in this country. I went to Stanford. I saw the trips to Mexico. I saw young women try to hurt themselves. And it was really deeply, deeply concerning. During her confirmation hearing before this committee in 1993, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was asked several questions about her views on whether the Constitution protects a woman's right to abortion. She unequivocally confirmed her view that the Constitution protects a woman's right to abortion. And she explained it like this, and I quote, "The decision whether or not to bear a child is central to a woman's life, to her well-being and dignity. It's a decision she must make for herself. When government controls that decision for her, she is being treated as less than a fully adult human responsible for her own choice," end quote. At one point, our former colleague, Orrin Hatch, then the ranking member of this committee, commended her for her being, quote, "very forthright in talking about that," end quote. So I hope, and you have been thus far, be equally forthright with your answers. In Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, Justice Scalia, as was said earlier, joined the dissent, which took the position, and I quote, "We believe that Roe was wrongly decided and that it can and should be overruled, consistent with our traditional approach to stare decisis in constitutional cases." Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided?
So, Senator, I do want to be forthright and answer every question so far as I can. I think on that question, I'm going to invoke Justice Kagan's description, which I think is perfectly put. When she was in her confirmation hearing, she said that she was not going to grade precedent or give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And I think in an area where precedent continues to be pressed and litigated, as is true of Casey, it would be particularly, it would actually be wrong and a violation of the canons for me to do that as a sitting judge. So if I express a view on a precedent one way or another, whether I say I love it or I hate it, it signals to litigants that I might tilt one way or another in a pending case.
So on something that is really a major cause with major effect on over half of the population of this country, who are women, after all, it's distressing not to get a straight answer. So let me try again. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided?
Senator, I completely understand why you are asking the question, but again, I can't pre-commit or say, yes, I'm going in with some agenda, because I'm not. I don't have any agenda. I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come.
Well, what I'm, as a person, I don't know if you'll answer this one either. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe can and should be overturned by the Supreme Court?
Well, I think my answer is the same because, you know, that's a case that's litigated. It could, you know, its contours could come up again. In fact, do come up. You know, they came up last term before the court. So I think, you know, what the Casey standard is, and that's just, it's a contentious issue, which is, I know, one reason why it would be comforting to you to have an answer. But I can't express views on cases or pre-commit to approaching a case any particular way.
Well, that makes it difficult for me, and I think for other women also on this committee, because this is a very important case, and it affects a lot of people, millions and millions of women, and you could be a very important vote. And I had hoped you would say, as a person, you've got a lovely family. You understand all the implications of family life. You should be very proud of that. I'm proud of you for that. But my position is a little different. You're going on the biggest court of this land with a problem out there that all women see one way or another in their life. And not all, but yeah, certainly married women do, and others too. And so the question comes, what happens? And will this justice support a law that has substantial precedent now? Would you commit yourself on whether you would or would not?
Senator, what I will commit is that I will obey all the rules of stare decisis, that if a question comes up before me about whether Casey or any other case should be overruled, that I will follow the law of stare decisis, applying it as the court has articulated it, applying all the factors, reliance, workability, being undermined by later facts and law, just all the standard factors. And I promise to do that for any issue that comes up, abortion or anything else. I'll follow the law.
Well, I think that's expected. And I guess I've gone as far as I can. Let me go to another issue. This country is facing great gun violence. There's been a surge in gun sales during the COVID-19 crisis, which has led to more lives being needlessly lost. According to the Gun Violence Archive, an independent research organization, there were 60 mass shootings in May alone. These shootings killed 40 people. They hurt 250 more. Also, there's been a troubling spike in gun sales. Americans bought approximately 2 million guns this past March. It's the second highest month ever for gun sales. That figure does not take into account all the gun sales that could not be completed because the purchaser failed a background test, a number that has also skyrocketed. For example, this past March, the FBI's background check system blocked 23,692 sales, more than double the 9,500 sales blocked in March of 2019. Do you agree that federal, state, and local governments have a compelling interest in preventing a rise in gun violence, particularly during a pandemic.
Well, Senator, of course, the constitutionality of any particular measure that were passed, that was passed by state or local governments or by this body, would be subject to the same judicial process that I described with Senator Graham. What I will say, as because this is just descriptive of Heller, Heller leaves room for gun regulations. And that's why there has been a lot of litigation in the lower courts, which makes me constrained not to comment on the limits of it. But Heller does not make a right absolute, by its, says so in the opinion.
Well, let me ask one more question. In a recent dissenting opinion that you wrote, you said there was, quote, no question, end quote, that, quote, keeping guns out of the hands of those who are likely to misuse them, quote, is, quote, a very strong governmental interest. Do you stand by that statement?
So, I can't remember precisely the words of Cantor, which is the case in which I dissented.
Cantor v. Barr.
Cantor v. Barr. What I said in that opinion, I stand by, which is that the original meaning of the Second Amendment, and I went through a lot of detailed history in that case, does support the idea that governments are free to keep guns out of the hands of the dangerous. So, for example, the mentally ill, others who would be likely to misuse guns.
So where does that leave you on Roe? The chairman asked, I thought, a very good question. For many people, and particularly for women, this is a fundamental question. We all have our moral values. We have our religions. We live by that. I respect you and your family for doing just that. But this is a very real problem out there. And if you could be more specific in any way with respect how you would view your place on the court with respect to controlling weapons in this country.
I think what I can say is that my opinion in Cantor shows how I approach questions as a matter of judicial philosophy. I mean, I spent a lot of time in that opinion looking at the history of the Second Amendment and looking at the Supreme Court's cases. And so the way in which I would approach the review of gun regulation is in that same way, to look very carefully at the text, to look carefully at what the original meaning was. That was the method that both the majority and dissent in Heller took. So I promised that I would come to that with an open mind, applying the law as I could best determine it.
Okay, let me move on. One of my constituents, Christina Garcia, was able to obtain insurance coverage and have surgery that saved her eyesight only before the Affordable Care Act. Her experience is not unique. Senator Tammy Baldwin has a constituent, Jimmy Anderson, in her home state of Wisconsin, and she asked that this story be shared. Jimmy is a 34-year-old and member of the Wisconsin State Legislature. In 2010, a drunk driver hit the family's car as they were returning home from celebrating Jimmy's 24th birthday. Jimmy's mother, father, and little brother were killed in the accident. Jimmy was paralyzed from the waist down. His medical recovery was intense. As Jimmy has said, quote, doctors managed to patch me up with dozens of stitches and multiple surgeries and about a pound of steel on my spine, end quote. But soon after, his insurance company told him he was nearing his lifetime maximums and he would have to pay for the rest of his health care expenses. As Jimmy explains, quote, with hundreds of thousands of dollars still left to go, I don't know what I was going to do. I was scared. I was terrified. I was just a student. I didn't have that kind of money. Fortunately, a few days later, the insurance company sent him another letter. This one informed him that the provisions of the ACA had kicked in, which meant there were no longer lifetime maximums and his care would be covered. In Jimmy's own words, I was able to put my life back together, and I credit the Affordable Care Act for that. Judge Barrett, how should the loss of ACA's protection against lifetime coverage caps, caps that can be used to end coverage for life-saving care, factor into a court's consideration of the validity of the ACA?
Senator, so far as I know, the case next week doesn't present that issue. It's not a challenge to pre-existing conditions coverage or to the lifetime maximum, you know, relief from a cap.
Well, what is your view?
Of how it should factor in? I think that any issue that would arise under the Affordable Care Act or any other statute should be determined by the law, by looking at the text of the statute, by looking at precedent, the same way that it would for anyone. And if there were policy differences or policy consequences, those are for this body. For the court, it's really a question of adhering to the law and going where the law leads and leaving the policy decisions up to you.
For me, my vote depends a lot on these responses, because these are life or death questions for people. It's my understanding that you were critical of Justice Roberts for upholding the ACA, stating that he, quote, pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute, end quote. And in what way did the Chief Justice go beyond the ACA's plausible meaning?
So I've written about this, and that description is consistent with the way the Chief Justice described in his own majority. That was King versus Burwell, where the court had to decide whether the phrase established by a state also included exchanges that were established by the federal government. And the majority in that case acknowledged that treating the phrase established by a state as including exchanges established by the federal government was not the most natural reading, but for other reasons, other policy reasons and canons of interpretation, they chose to adopt the less natural reading.
You see, for me, the case coming up, California v. Texas, puts a whole new weight on your nomination. Because the Affordable Care Act is now being so well accepted. I represent the largest state, as does Senator Harris, that we have. And there are just over 10 million people dependent on the activities under this act and that they be sustained. And so there is really great concern about what your view is. That case is coming up. Can you give us at least your view?
Well, Senator, the issue in the case that's coming up doesn't involve, it's not the same issue as the ones in NFIB versus Sebelius or King versus Burwell. It's a different issue.
Well, so, then give us both.
Well, let's see. So what I said, what you quoted to me, was that I thought that the interpretation of the phrase established by a state was stretched when the court held that it was established by the federal government. That's not the issue in California versus Texas. The issue in California versus Texas is if whether now that Congress has just completely, you know, zeroed out the mandate, whether it's still a tax or a penalty, and even if so, is it constitutional? And then even so, is that fatal to the statute? There's a doctrine called severability, which sounds like legalese, but what it means is it okay with the statute? Could you just pluck that part out and let the rest of the statute stand? Or is that provision, which has been zeroed out, so critical to the statute that the whole statute falls? So really the issue in the case is this doctrine of severability, and that's not something that I've ever talked about with respect to the Affordable Care Act. Honestly, I haven't written anything about severability that I know of at all.
So you have no thoughts on the subject?
Well, it's a case that's on the court's docket, and the canons of judicial conduct, you know, would prohibit me from expressing a view.
Okay, I'll move on. On July 30th, 2020, President Trump made claims of voter fraud and suggested he wanted to delay the upcoming election. Does the Constitution give the President of the United States the authority to unilaterally delay a general election under any circumstances? Does federal law?
Well, Senator, if that question ever came before me, I would need to hear arguments from the litigants and read briefs and consult with my law clerks and talk to my colleagues and go through the opinion writing process. So, you know, if I give off-the-cuff answers, then I would be basically a legal pundit. And I don't think we want judges to be legal pundits. I think we want judges to approach cases thoughtfully and with an open mind.
Okay, let me try something else. In 2017, in a case called EEOC v. AutoZone, the Seventh Circuit, your circuit, issued an opinion which permitted an employer to intentionally assign its employees to specific stores due to their race. The dissent in this opinion argued the decision permitted employers to legally establish separate but equal facilities and argued, if upheld, this decision would be, quote, contrary to the position that the Supreme Court has taken in analogous equal protection cases as far back as Brown v. the Board of Education. The case was appealed to the full panel of the Seventh, and you sided, as I understand it, with the majority to deny a rehearing and let the opinion stand. Is that correct?
That is correct, and I think I need to give a little context for what it means to vote to deny, to rehear something en banc. Our court, just like the Supreme Court and the certiorari process, doesn't take cases just because we think the panel got it wrong. There's a lot of deference to panels, and Rule 35 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure constrains and limits the times in which we take the resources of the full court to rehear a case. So I was not on that panel, and I did not express a view on the merits. A vote to deny to hear something en banc is like a vote not to deny certiorari, not a vote that expresses a view on the merits.
Okay.
It was a statutory case. It was not an equal protection case.
Let me ask you a question as a person.
Yes.
If an employer can transfer an employee based solely on his or her race, and that does not constitute a materially adverse employment action because it was purely lateral job transfer, please explain what factors must be present for a policy based on race to violate Brown v. the Board's prohibition of separate but equal.
Well, Senator, to my knowledge, Brown wasn't at issue in the majority opinion. It turned on statutory language in Title VII. But again, I didn't express a view on the merits, and so I can't comment on whether I think that the panel majority got that right or got that wrong. You know, that's an issue that may well come before me, even in the Seventh Circuit. Some may press for its overruling, and I may be on a panel that has to decide whether that precedent was wrong.
Well, let me ask you, as a person, do you have a general belief?
As a person, I have a general belief that racism is abhorrent.
That racism is what?
Abhorrent.
Well, I think that's I think we would all agree with that. So how should a lower court in the Seventh determine when race-based policies could constitute a materially adverse employment action?
Well, I'm not aware of cases presenting the exact same facts as that.
Just asking you for your view.
You know, I know that the material adverse consequence was the standard at issue in that case. I have to confess that I would need to look at the statute and the precedent to, well, even if I had a specific hypothetical in front of me, I couldn't really say without looking at the statute and the precedent what factors are involved, because I wasn't on that panel and haven't decided a similar case.
Okay, let me go to another issue. The issue of LGBT equality is very personal for me. I spent 2 decades as a county supervisor and mayor of a city. I watched firsthand as the LGBT community fought for legal recognition of their lives, their relationships, their personal dignity. I was there before the law, so I saw in San Francisco what was happening. I want to speak briefly about one couple, Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who I met in the 1970s. They were vibrant members of San Francisco's community. I was president of the Board of Supervisors. They worked with me to pass a citywide ordinance in 1978 that provided critical protection against discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. At that time, this was one of the strongest protections for the gay community in the entire nation. We've come a long way since then, and I think we should never go back. In June of 2008, 58 years after they met, my two friends were finally able to marry when the California Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples cannot be denied the fundamental right to marry. Del died 2 months later. Because of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, Phyllis was denied Social Security survivor benefits, even though her spouse had paid into this basic safety net for her entire working life. Phil had to rely on the help of friends and fellow activists. In 2013, as you probably know, because you know so much about this, U.S. v. Windsor, the Supreme Court struck DOMA down. 2 years later, in Obergefell v. Hodges, the Supreme Court recognized that the fundamental right to marry could not be denied to LGBT Americans. Both decisions were decided by a 5-4 margin. Justice Ginsburg was in the majority. Justice Scalia dissented in both cases. Now, you said in your acceptance speech for this nomination that Justice Scalia's philosophy is your philosophy. Do you agree with this particular point of Justice Scalia's view, that the U.S. Constitution does not afford gay people the fundamental right to marry?
Senator Feinstein, as I said to Senator Graham at the outset, if I were confirmed, you would be getting Justice Barrett, not Justice Scalia. So I don't think that anybody should assume that just because Justice Scalia decided a decision a certain way that I would too. But I'm not going to express a view on whether I agree or disagree with Justice Scalia for the same reasons that I've been giving. You know, Justice Ginsburg, with her characteristic pithiness, used this to describe how a nominee should comport herself at a hearing. No hints, no previews, no forecasts. That had been the practice of nominees before her, but everybody calls it the Ginsburg rule because she stated it so concisely, and it's been the practice of every nominee since. So I can't, and I'm sorry to not be able to embrace or disavow Justice Scalia's position, but I really can't do that on any point of law.
Well, that's really too bad, because it's rather a fundamental point for large numbers of people, I think, in this country. I understand you don't want to answer these questions directly, but you identify yourself with a justice that you, like him, would be a consistent vote to roll back hard-fought freedom.
This is special coverage of the Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Judge Amy Coney Barrett from NPR News.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Their staff can answer your questions about pre-planning a meaningful funeral or memorial service. They consider it an honor to serve families in our community since 1931. KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
On the questions of law, however, I just, because I'm a sitting judge, and because you can't answer questions without going through the judicial process, can't give answers to those very specific questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Feinstein. Senator Grassley.
Yeah. Judge, welcome you again. And you can rest for a minute because I've got some things to say to my colleagues,